I'd like to introduce our keynote speaker, Stella Bruzzi. Stella is professor of film and television studies and a chair of the Faculty of Arts at the University of Warwick. Stella's main research interests are gender and identity in film, particularly masculinity, documentary film and television, and fashion and costume. Stella's numerous publications include two studies on fashion, the monograph Undressing Cinema, Clothing and Identity in the Movies from 1997, and that was followed by Fashion Cultures, Theories, Histories and Analysis, which she co-edited with Pamela Church Gibson. New Documentaries is already in its second edition with Routledge. Stella's most recent book analyzes the seminal British television series 7-Up and was published by the BFI Television Classics series. Her study, Men's Cinema, examines masculinity in relation to mise-en-scène and follows on from her research into masculinity and cinema undertaken for her earlier book project, Bringing Up Daddy, Fatherhood and Masculinity in Postwar Hollywood, which was published in 2005. I learned a lot from reading Stella's wide-ranging, witty and wonderful book on Hollywood fathers. And that's why I decided to invite Stella as a keynote speaker to the conference today. Stella will be looking at Hollywood's Italian-American fathers in her paper and will try to answer a very simple question. Why are they so awful? Over to Stella.
I feel slightly fraudulent as a kind of Hollywood person, but anyway, I'll plow on. The Italian diaspora, from about the time of the unification of Italy in the 1960s, saw millions of Italians leaving Italy. Their emigration was primarily a response to extreme poverty, especially amongst those from Il Mezzogiorno, or the Italian South. As an example of the cinematic representations of the division of Italy along class and wealth lines, the relative poverty of that population compared to the much more industrialised and affluent north of the country, there are the films of the golden age of Italian cinema, from neorealism to the 1970s, Rossellini, Visconti, Pasolini. The United States was from about the 1880s to just after the Second World War, the main destination for Italian immigrants who travelled beyond Europe, most of whom arrived at New York and settled in the cities, New York itself, Boston, Chicago, Philadelphia, San Francisco, New Orleans. However, the vast majority of Italians who went to America settled in the New England and North Atlantic areas, nearly 80% of them in the larger cities. Hence the appearance in more than one film of New York City. It is interesting that many comment on the fact that Italians didn't emigrate with intention of actually settling in the US, although many of them ended up doing just that and making America their permanent home. To give you some idea of the numbers, whereas in 1840 fewer than 4,000 Italians were reportedly living in the US, by 1880 there were 44,000, and by 1900 just over 484,000. It is, however, a relatively small immigrant group within the US population. And as I've indicated, there's a kind of clear set, there's a definite sense of the type of Italian who did go to America. 80% are considered to have been from the Mezzogiorno and from Sicily. Italians have in America traditionally taken a variety of manual jobs, but predictably, for example, see the mafia euphemism, I work in construction. The most popular profession has been the building and railroad industries. The underpinning issues when it comes to discussing immigrant groups is, I think, integration or not. Italians in Hollywood movies, like many other immigrant groups, are represented as either unable or unwilling to integrate, or to view immersion in American culture and society as dependent on a rejection of their Italianness. It is often the father, the head of the household, in inverted commas, who exemplifies this ambivalence, who brings Italianness with him, but who teaches his children to be both Italian and American. Fathers fathers exemplify hybridity. A father's children frequently reject him. I mean, I'm talking about Italian fathers, sorry. His children frequently reject even that amount of Italian identity when they reject him, as they often do. In discussing Italian-American fathers in Hollywood, I'm also interested in another form of integration, I suppose, of being embraced by a dominant culture, being embraced by Hollywood. As with the mafia euphemism, the Italian-American male in Hollywood is a figure constructed around frequently contradictory clichés and stereotypes, and I'll name but a few. Excessive machismo. Amongst the older generation, homophobia and distrust of, even disgust at, the effeminate man. Which is ironic, really, considering that the most violent gangsters are usually also vain and overly preoccupied with their clothes and style. There's also a love of everything, you know, all kind of things Italian. A love of spaghetti, opera, and wine predominate. There's a zealous attachment to the family, family values, and the home country. And there's an over-attachment to traditional values, the autocratic paternal model, for example, sexism, patriarchy in general, and sharply and regressively differentiated gender roles. There's a tendency towards infidelity, and if not that, ogling and general lecherousness whilst looking at the female form. There's the exaggerated use of hand gestures, mannered speech, which usually function as some kind of shorthand for crudeness and a lack of sophistication. Although Italian-American women in American cinema are often a bit more sussed, for example, the Annabella Sciorra character in Spike Lee's Jungle Fever, their male counterparts, if you look at John Turturro in that same film, are often endearingly naive and dim. Dimness is often manifested in these films as gullibility, generosity, buffoonery. There's also, obviously, that other opposite trait, criminality and violence, and in particular, embroilment in organised crime. And lastly, but certainly not least, there's an overt preoccupation with class, with being proud to remain working class, with wanting to escape the working class, with social aspiration and or financial aspiration, and they're not quite the same thing. But in many cases, the man's Italian identity is an essential part of what holds him back. Why the Italian-American father is of particular interest is not simply that he embodies many of these more general masculine traits and values, but that he is frequently the most regressive, the most macho Italian of the lot. The obvious example here is the Hollywood gangster, which, perversely perhaps, I'm actually not going to talk about very much. I think perhaps because he's kind of very well known. Hollywood's Italian fathers are usually first generation Americans, and they still quite often have a thick accent, whether it is Italian or not. And they've maintained close ties with their Italianist culture and country. Think, for example, of the flashbacks to Vito Corleone's childhood and adolescence in The Godfather. They have also more or less successfully drummed their values into their children, but their children, especially their sons, often rebel against or reject this tradition. And now to feature I will look at more closely later. As a way of engaging with Hollywood's representation of the Italian-American father, I intend to focus on two specific paternal archetypes, the benign Italian-American father model on the one hand, and his counterpart, the excessively violent father. Both are, in their different ways, negative, but the former also exhibits the sort of kind condescension that often characterises Hollywood's less brutish depictions of Italian masculinity. Model A, therefore, the benign father model, is exemplified by Joseph L. Mankiewicz's 1949 film House of Strangers, in which Edward G. Robinson plays plays the character Gino Monetti, a self-made, self-styled banker with four sons, three of whom want him dead. Although Robinson himself was actually Romanian, this is actually one of two Italians that he plays. He also played, as many of you know, Rico in Mervyn LeRoy's 1931 definitive gangster film, Little Caesar. In the House of Strangers, having been chaotically generous with his money, offering loans, as you will see, to fellow Italians without sufficient collateral to offset them, Gino is, before the clips that I'm going to show you, put on trial. Max, Gino's only favoured son, takes the rap for his father and goes to jail for 7 years. Whilst in jail, Gino dies, and the sequences with the father are in flashback. In these flashbacks, House of Strangers represents an early example of the benign father model. Now I will attempt. Before showing you something of Gino working, I'd like to talk about this clip briefly. This is the professionally highly successful father as kind of amiable buffoon, laughing childishly, domineering, and obviously patriarchal. This is one of the sons who is not one of the favourite, who is not Max. Not entirely in contradistinction to, however, his daytime professional role. He assumes his sons are there, for example, to do his bidding. He assumes that the bank, likewise, is simply going to open when he gets there, partly because, as he implies, he is over-generous.
The import people are calling again about their loan. Now the shipment is under dock.
Not now, after a little while. First I take care of my friends. Oh, look out.
Gino, io ho bisogno di qualche cosa di moneta perché mi ha morto
il cavallo. Parla in classe, qui siamo in America, how many times I tell you, speak English. You got to learn sometime.
I'm gonna need some money to buy one horse.
What for you need a horse?
The old one, she died. She cannot pick up the junk.
How much it cost one horse?
$150.
Sign here.
Did you okay $80,000 on a housing project?
See?
A fellow from Chicago is on the telephone. Wants to know if you renew on the brewery.
Hello? Do you know what I think? No.
Okay, I'll just cut it there. Obviously here you see Gino taking care of his friends, by which he means Italians. He is obviously wily, keeping back the interest on the personal loan, but he's also generous, excessively generous. The early scene of Godfather 1, in which you see Vito sitting in a darkened room as his daughter's wedding continues outside, hearing his friends' problems and offering to help them, is deeply reminiscent of this scene. Gino is also impatient with these friends for not being American enough and for automatically speaking Italian with him. However, he himself doesn't ever lose his own Italianness.
Now, look, Silvio, if you want, I hear you've got to speak more strong.
Opera is often used, is often the Italian man's cultural touchstone, his kind of talisman, if you like. Gino's response here is instinctive and primal. It's not particularly discerning, but his affiliation with Figaro is sort of innate, if you like. It lacks sophistication, but is endearing. He likes it loud. He is proud of his phonogram. There's a sense in which, however, later you see him commanding one of his sons just to change the record, that he would like anything that kind of made him think of his own Italianness. His success is here, obviously, still very much embedded in the framing of the scene by the portrait above the mantelpiece, and his smoking jacket, and his kind of talismanic cigar. But he hasn't forgotten his roots. Just a bit later, you see the family finally sitting down to dinner.
Non c'è nessuna cosa al mondo che adoro più dei tuoi spaghetti.
Grazie.
Cucinare gli spaghetti è un arte.
Ma sa,
è un
buon
cuoco, è un artista.
Ma che se sono veramente cuochi?
Il mondo è pieno di buoni cuochi e di leonisti, ma pochi sono i veri artisti. E tu, moglie mia, sei una grande artista. Tu! Pietro, dove? Alzati un po'.
Okay. Here, Gino's contradictory character again emerges. The success that permits him to spot... Sorry, I'm reading the wrong bit. You haven't got to the next bit, which is quite funny. Sorry. Eating features as you'd imagine quite a lot in Hollywood's Italian families. The family dinner is a sacred ritual when, as you can see here, generations come together. Spaghetti is also the dish used repeatedly as the national dish. It's not just pasta, it's the long pasta. Here, Gino serves the pasta as if he's carving the Thanksgiving turkey. He also sends his mother a kiss. Gestures come to the fore when he's being most Italian. And finally...
That's my boy, Pietro. What it says on the bathroom.
And the fight has stopped. Here, Gino's contradictory character comes to the fore. The success that permits him to sponsor his son Pietro's doomed boxing career, as well as the father's blindness to his son's inadequacies. For all his geniality, there are several ways in which House of Strangers is suggestive of Gino's overwhelming presence. The music is loud and insistent. Spaghetti are served up every night, and he runs his son's affairs. However, he's still the kind of slightly, childish, amiable buffoon. Gino's is, however, a brand of flawed but benign patriarchy that recalls other Italian-American fathers. The father, for example, in Norman Jewison's Moonstruck, is one of many flawed but forgivable Italian rogues. The father's flaw here is pretty fundamental for a Catholic. He's been cheating on his long-suffering wife. But he is forgiven and is readily recuperated into the family in a way that both teases and applauds Italianness. I will return to issues about language and speech in a moment. First, you get here the chronic philanderer being welcomed back into the family fold relatively easily. in front of his extended family, which is just about to be extended even further with the arrival of an uncle and aunt. The father's adulterous machismo is here unproblematically beaten into submission by that quintessential image of middle-aged Italian femininity, a quietly spoken wife in a housecoat, and by a return to Italian, to their core defining values, to what makes them them, as they say, ti amo, to each other, I love you. The benign father possesses a primitivism he shares with his significantly more violent counterpart. In English especially, he is not good with words. A lack of fluency, a lack of integration into American society, signalled by here Scher's father and mother returning to Italian to state their love for each other, and Gino returning to opera. Underpinning many of these images is the enduring archetype of the Italian male who relies on physicality and violence rather than on words and on intellect. The boxers in, for example, Rocky, or the whole Rocky series, or Martin Scorsese's Raging Bull, whose thick speech is unclear and who remain painfully inarticulate. Think of Raging Bull, which opens with Jake LaMotta practicing his awful nightclub jokes, and also towards the end has a scene in which he pummels the walls of a police cell, shouting, "I'm not an animal. I'm not an animal." Even in the older man and father, speech is important. Gino telling the Italian man who comes for a loan to speak English because they're in America. The use of Italian at the end of Moonstruck is another example of this. English for these hybrid first-generation American men is laboured, unnatural, but something that they have to speak. Integration is far from complete. The most famously mumbling Italian-American father is probably Marlon Brando's portrayal of Vito Corleone in Francis Ford Coppola's The Godfather, which I said I wouldn't have any gangsters, but I suppose I had to have one. With Vito, we are clearly leaving behind the benign father archetype and moving into the violent archetype. Although here there's still a deep romanticism in Coppola's portrayal of the padrino. We are also in this sequence offered two other essential traits of Hollywood's Italian father. Aspiration, and social aspiration, but also a real naivety, that he has fantasized, for example, that Michael could become Senator Corleone. And the realization that Michael's inability to escape the mafia also signals his inability to be subsumed into the white middle class inhabited with ease by his WASP wife, Kay, played by Diane Keaton. In taking over from his father, Michael here chooses to remain attached to his Italian roots. I'm going to talk in a minute. I'm going to spend the rest of the paper talking about Robert Mulligan's film Blood Brothers from 1978, which for me epitomises the kind of violent Italian father archetype that one can contrast with the one in House of Strangers. There are, again, however, plenty of other examples I could have chosen. In, for example, Spike Lee's film Jungle Fever, as I hinted at earlier, there are two Italian fathers whose portrayals borders, I think, on the racist. There is Annabella Sciorra's father, who's a loudmouth slob flanked by two totally Neanderthal sons, who, upon hearing that his daughter is dating a black man, Wesley Snipes, beats Angie viciously with a belt, ashamed to be the father of a nigger lover. Again, in Jungle Fever, John Turturro's father, played by Anthony Quinn, forces his way into the bathroom where he finds his son crying, having been jilted by Angie, that is, Annabella Shaw, just a bit before. Lou doesn't force his way in to comfort Paulie, but to clout him around the head for snivelling over a bit of skirt, as he puts it. The percentage of working-class fathers in Hollywood has, over the decades, been actually relatively low, except, that is, amongst non-white and other immigrant populations. Blood Brothers, which is one such example, features a working-class Italian-American family headed by Tommy DeCoco. Whereas the family unit in The Godfather could be seen as perversely cohesive, the family unit in Mulligan's Blood Brothers is, largely due to Tommy's macho posturing and violence, painfully dysfunctional. Tommy has two sons, Stoney, played by Richard Gere, and Albert, who is anorexic. Tommy is an adulterous Italian whose ignorance, inarticulacy, and brutality are unpalatably symptomatic of his working classness. Blood Brothers' struggle between father and son is also the struggle between two types of Italian manhood. The brutish construction worker father and his much more sensitive son, who wants to work with kids, and you'll see in that in a minute, and who aspires to middle classness, leaving behind the grim New York suburbs for Manhattan, much as John Travolta does in Saturday Night Fever. What I'm going to play now is a bit of a scene in which the kind of central struggle is acted out between father and son.
What do you got?
He's asked his son to write down what he wants to do.
What's this? These are three things. What's this say? This is work with kids. Well, you want to be a nursery school teacher. And what do you want to do, run around the room? No, not funny. What are you going to call yourself, Mr. Coco?
Look, it's in a hospital, right?
Game. You out of your fucking mind? You make more 2 weeks of me than Candy Stripe and Tom Mine.
And then Candy Stripe, I'm gonna be a recreational assistant.
You're gonna be a what?
A recreational assistant.
Recreational assistant is woman's work.
Oh, right, sorry. I'm very sorry. I should wear work boots and a hard hat. Then I'll be a real man, right?
Fucking talk out of your mind. I can still kick your fucking ass all over the goddamn room.
Don't you ever touch me like that again.
Okay. Here, Tommy pins his son Stoney to the wall and persuades him in a moment to trial both forms of work, the kind of sissy and the manly. He wants him to... If he's going to do woman's work, he also wants him to at least come with him for a couple of weeks to his construction site. Tommy can see no midpoint, either total immersion in his macho culture or total rejection of it. There's no other form of masculinity that his son can aspire to, can become. The narrative in this film is built around a series of such polarities. Tommy's old-fashioned old man's bar, as opposed to Stoney's 1970s young man's bar. Stoney's traditional and then his much more liberated girlfriends. Stoney does then trial both forms of work, and I'll show you a couple of bits of them, especially as it says something about Richard Gere's acting, which is quite... Anyway.
A couple months later, a bunch of clenches. No.
This is his first day at work with the kids.
Comes
sorry, otherwise I'm going to run out of time and we're not going to get a Saturday Night Fever. So there's the first day at nursery, and then a couple of weeks later, he then does the trial on the construction site with his dad.
Hey, Stone, this ain't no way to start off here.
Man, all the way around. Hey,
grandmother
would
have got it up here faster.
Fucking coffee's ice cold.
I told you no sugar. Son of a bitch, I'm a diabetic. What do you want me to do? We're going to come up.
Stand up. Step it up.
Hey, 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 hey,
hey. Your pants help you feel too big, huh?
No. Why?
Getting your ass off.
So there you get the kind of protracted initiation ceremony into the world of men. These scenes in the film come adjacent to each other, and the point is obviously to contrast them. The father's world and the son and the world that the son wants to enter. It's via Stoney's start life work choices that the differences between him and Tommy become articulated. The hospital scene, I think, implies, is a natural children's recreational assistant, but he is ill-suited to his father's life of construction and hard hats, although he fleetingly enjoys it, as you see in the following scene when he goes with them to the old man's bar. He finds it hard to at this stage, reject his father completely. He is much more sensitive than his father. He, for example, looks after his younger brother Albert, and at the end of the film takes him away. But what finally makes him have to totally reject his father is that his father beats his mother up so badly that she ends up in the hospital. I'll just play the beginning of this, but it's a...
You okay?
Regardless of what you think, nothing happened. Stoney, I swear nothing happened.
Yeah.
No, I just...
So you're okay, man?
Then following this, there's a classic Hollywood scene in which the father is in bed. Quite often the father in these scenes is dying, he isn't here. And the son goes in. Usually it's a point of reconciliation. In this film it's not. This is the point. Seeing his mother like this is the point at which Stoney decides he cannot stay with his father, and he takes his brother Albert away and makes sure that his mother's safe, leaving her with his uncle. Barbara Ehrenreich, placing Blood Brothers alongside Saturday Night Fever, Blue Collar and Breaking Away, argues that in Mulligan's film, and I quote Ehrenreich here, the masculine alternatives are laid out with stark clarity. Stoney DeCoker can either be a man like his father and uncle, or he can, in the film's terms, grow up. Tommy's traditional masculinity is obviously regressive. His aggression, uncontrollable. It's a very long and difficult, painful scene, the one just before this when he beats his mum up. And his sexism is ingrained. All these traits are also indirectly symptoms of his Italian identity. As Robert Griswold suggested, immigrant fathers, he is writing specifically about Italian fathers here, were liminal figures suspended between an old culture and a new. Children of European fathers Fathers of American Children. Made at the end of the 1970s, Blood Brothers is also about other divides. The generational divide between the sensitised, radicalised post-1960s children and their traditional parents. It is also, most crucially, about escape from Tommy, manual labour, the working class Italian family and their neighbourhood. Tommy, like Italian masculinity, cannot change. He thinks he can, but he's caught in his stereotype. Stoney, unlike Michael Corleone, can and does escape, taking Albert with him. So as not to leave you totally depressed, I suddenly realised as I was writing this, I thought, God, I should have done it the other way around, but I didn't. To conclude, I'll play you Saturday Night Fever. I mean, not obviously not the whole thing, just a little bit.
Yourself.
He's a priest, ain't he? Father Frank Jr., your brother.
Your mother doesn't have too much to cross yourself about these things.
You're so jealous of Frank Jr.
Oh, shut up, will you? Hey! Where are you? Boom! And shut up, watch the show, stupid!
Basta!
All right, come on.
Manja, manja!
Yeah, go ahead, see. I got more podcasts, Mr. Jim.
What do you mean you got more podcasts? I'm not awake.
Yeah, well, as long as we got a dollar left, we eat good in this house.
What?
Yeah, I'm not even gonna drop myself.
I can't do 25 years of construction work, I always brought home a paycheck. What, 6-7 months I'm out of work? And all of a sudden what? You hit? I'm talking back.
All right.
Talking about getting a job and hitting
all right,
me.
All right, no hitting, no slamming at the dinner table, okay? That's the rule. Hmm? You was once hit.
You never hit me before. Never. Not for kids. One pork chop! One!
Hey, Frank!
Disgusting, I said. We just washed the hair. No, I work on my hair a long time, and he hit it. He hits my hair.
Sorry, I had to let it run. He hits my hair. All the elements of the Italian-American father, to conclude, are here. Not understanding the son, a sexist attachment to clearly defined gender roles, being poor, out of work, gratuitously, and instinctively physical and aggressive, and a lover of pasta with chops. That always intrigues me. Happens in Moonstruck as well. Whereas the dad here is caught in the stereotype of the Italian-American father. Tony, through his dancing, is breaking away and is forging an individualised identity beyond and outside ethnicity. Ethnicity symbolised by his father. And so to conclude, at least with reference to my question, why are they so awful? I found I actually couldn't answer my own question, I'm afraid. These fathers represent only excessively narrow and overly negative aspects of Italian masculinity and paternity. They won't and can't change. They're often dim and certainly naive. They're violent and inclined to find an identity within organised criminal groups. Or if not within that, then with a very closed Italian community. Their attachment to family values, Catholicism, opera, spaghetti, is usually instinctive, is not sort of thought through, and is certainly, it is not particularly deep. Could many other minority groups be so consistently laughed at in this way? Thank you.